Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we're prepared to take our final look at the life and crimes of Rodney Alcala. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. Don't forget to like and subscribe as well. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content such as my look at the Columbine Massacre, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, have done, and as my two biggest supporters, Samantha and Debbie, have done. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last time, Rodney Alcala was preparing to go on trial for murder. This was the murder of Robin Christine Samso. That was the 12-year-old who he had kidnapped on her way to the ballet lessons. To say that Alcala faced a massive uphill battle is an understatement. They had witness testimony that placed him with Robin, as well as witness testimony that placed Alcala and his station wagon in the mountains where Robin's body was eventually found. They also had the testimony of the three convicts who were turning state's evidence against him. If you look online, you're going to see some erroneous reports that the people of California versus Rodney James Alcala started in May of 1980. However, according to court documents, the trial actually started in March of 1980, specifically March 6th. So we just passed the 45th anniversary of the start of Rodney Alcala's first murder trial. The state was represented by District Attorney Richard Farnell, while Alcala was represented by John Barnett. In their opening statements, the state said that Alcala had killed Robin Samose beyond any reasonable doubt, and that testimony from witnesses along with physical evidence would show that Alcala was indeed guilty. While the defense stated that the prosecution's star witness, Dana Crappa, was an unreliable witness with a history of mental illness, and they questioned whether or not it was legal for an individual with mental illness to be called to the stand and if that individual's testimony could be trusted. This was in reference to Dana Crappa's self-reported memory loss issues. The defense also stated that the other testimony they were going to hear was from men who were receiving reduced sentences from the state in order to compel them to testify. And this is a fairly normal tactic by the defense. Anytime that there is a jailhouse snitch or a jailhouse informant, they point out that the individual who's going to be testifying is receiving a reduced sentence for whatever crime it is. It's very rare that an individual will agree to testify against another inmate without the offer of some kind of plea deal, but it does happen. However, it is not often. The defense rested its closing arguments by stating that they were sorry for Robin's friends and family, but they wished the police had done a better job finding the real killer. California called as its first witness the Forestry Service employee Dana Crapper. By most accounts, Dana Crapper gave chilling testimony describing in detail how she had witnessed the station wagon on two occasions in the area where Robin Samose's body had been discovered, and also how she had seen a dark-haired man dragging a blonde child up into the woods. Kappa then described how she had seen the young girl's corpse on a number of occasions in the days that followed. And during this testimony, the prosecution showed pictures of Alcala's Datsun station wagon, along with photographs of the crime scene, which some in the court found extremely disturbing. When asked whether or not she could identify the man she had seen leading the young girl up into the woods, Dana Crapper had no problem and showed no form of hesitation when she pointed to Rodney Alcala sitting at the defense table. Obviously, when the defense gets their shot at Dana Crapper, they tear into her mercilessly, questioning her as to why she had never contacted the police when she first saw the body, when she saw it the next time, and why she waited until the body was nearly unrecognizable as having belonged to a human before contacting the police. The defense claiming, as it questioned her, that Dana was a pathological liar who had made numerous inconsistent statements to the police and was only giving this testimony because she was a glory hound, while indicating that there might be the possibility of financial gain on Dana's part. Dana responded to all of this by explaining her short-term memory loss in great detail, even as the defense asked the judge to dismiss Dana's testimony and charge her with perjury. To this, Dana responded that she had been terrified of contacting the police, believing that she herself may have been considered a suspect in Robin's murder, stating, quote, "I know what I had done was wrong. I should have gone back or stopped on the afternoon of the 20th, or I should have said something to somebody. I could not justify what I had done. I began having nightmares. I would wake up at night completely startled in a cold sweat, unable to go back to sleep. I just woke up about as terrible at night as I did earlier when I was there on June the 25th. I tried to second-guess myself as to if I would have stopped, what would have happened." And it's at this point that the prosecution makes its major mistake. It begins detailing Rodney Alcala's various other sexual crimes, starting with Tally Shapiro's rape and attempted murder, Julie Johnson's abduction, and ending with the assault on Monique Hoyt. After this, the prosecution called four girls, the individuals that Alcala had been photographing roller skating against their will on June 20th of 1979. To emphasize that their testimony was indeed legitimate, the prosecution then showed the jury photographs of these young girls, which had been taken from the box of pictures Alcala had stored up in Seattle. The defense did little to try and negate these young girls' testimony. The next two witnesses to come forward were Bridget Wilvert and her aunt, Jackie Young, both of whom gave a detailed account of the 20th and of how Alcala had taken photographs of Bridget and Robin, with the aunt stating how she had come upon the trio and how Alcala had reacted to her before fleeing. Bridget also went into great detail about how she had lent Robin her bicycle and that that was the last time she had seen her best friend. After this, the prosecution called Marilyn Draws, who, if you'll recall, was the police sketch artist who had made the composite sketch that led to Alcala's identification by his parole officer and eventual arrest. The next witness to be called was Marianne Frazier. This is Robin Samoa's mother, who was an emotional wreck on the stand, both during examination and cross-examination by the defense. She broke down repeatedly on the stand, causing her testimony to drag out for hours on end. Robin's mother detailed how she had altered the earrings that her daughter had been wearing on the day she had disappeared. Despite how emotional Marianne Frazier was, the defense took great pains to try and discredit Marianne and to show that she was mistaken about the earrings her daughter was wearing, even going so far as to attempt to paint the mother as an absentee parent who wouldn't know what her daughter was up to on a given day. Things which Miss Frazier refuted in her testimony. After this, two of the inmates took the stand, Robert Dove and Michael Herrera. They both testified to their encounter with Alcala in the jail mess hall, stating that he had pretty much confessed to the about the kidnapping and murder without straight out coming and saying he had done the crimes. However, the defense, as was expected, ripped into both of these men pretty viciously in attempt to discredit the two of them. After redirect from the prosecution, the state rests its case. The first witness called by the defense was a man by the name of Tim Fallon, who claimed he had seen Robin Samoa on June 21st, which, if you'll recall, was a day after Robin had gone missing. Acting stunned at this revelation, the defense pressed further, eliciting a response from Mr. Fallon, wherein he said he saw the young girl describing what she was wearing, riding a yellow bicycle on Pacific View Avenue on the 21st. Fallon stated he was out watering his garden and that he had waved to the young girl and she had waved back. When shown a photograph of Robin Samoa, Mr. Fallon stated emphatically that that was the young girl he had seen. When questioned as to why he remembered this random chance encounter, Fallon stated that a few hours later, a police officer was out in the neighborhood handing out flyers containing a picture of the young girl that he had seen. When cross-examined by the prosecution, Fallon stated that he was 100% certain that the young girl he had seen on the 21st was indeed Robin. After this, Alcala's sisters took the stand, both of them stating in detail how he had called them after his interview at Knott's Berry Farm on June 20th. The defense then called a forensic psychologist who stated that it was his opinion that Dana Crappa had been manipulated by the police into accusing Rodney Alcala of the murder, at one point going so far as to state, quote, "Words were put into Miss Crappa's mouth." saying that it was his opinion that they had led Miss Crappa to suffer from false memory syndrome when she was in a vulnerable and suggestive state due to the emotional turmoil of the entire situation. Now, false memory syndrome is something that has plagued the courts since the 1970s, with some proponents believing that it is an actual thing, while opponents believe that it does not exist. Basically, it's the idea that an individual can remember something that never occurred in their life, with the memories being so strong, including the emotions behind them, that they come to believe that these memories are in fact truth. It's an extremely controversial topic that has been discussed multiple times in courts of law, as well as among academics. It falls into the same category as multiple personality disorder, which was made famous by a book and later a movie called Sybil. And just like multiple personality disorder, at least to the best of my knowledge, false memory syndrome has been largely debunked by psychiatrists. After this testimony, the defense made what I believe to be their major misstep when they start to discuss Rodney Alcala's antisocial personality disorder, which they said caused Alcala to disregard the rights of others as well as lower his moral inhibitions. Basically, the transcript of this reads as though the man is stating that, yes, my client is a scumbag, but here's the reason why, almost admitting that he had committed this crime without actually doing so. According to published reports from the time after this, the defense rested their case, and those in the courtroom were left wondering two things. Why had Alcala not testified in his own defense? And why had the man who had interviewed Alcala at Knott's Berry Farm on June 20th not been called to testify? The first is easy to surmise, as no defense team, unless they are 100% certain in the absolution of their client's innocence, is going to put their client on the stand where they will be subjected to cross-examination by the prosecution and may therefore hurt their chances of receiving a not guilty verdict. The second one is harder to discern. Some records indicate that the individual who had conducted the interview was no longer in the area or had fled the area. Others, that this individual may have died. I personally believe that it's more likely than not that this interview may never have in fact taken place, and that it was just a red herring thrown out by Alcala in order to try and establish an alibi. As could be expected during closing arguments, the prosecution painted Alcala as a pedophile monster who had taken the life of a 12-year-old girl and had a history of violent sexual crimes against underage girls. While the defense admitted in open court that Alcala was a sick and depraved individual who had committed the earlier crimes, stating that he sometimes goes into a frenzy, before pointing out that there was no physical evidence of any sort, be it DNA or otherwise, that linked Rodney Alcala to the murder of Robin Samos. After this, the prosecution is able to give another closing argument to refute the points of the defense before the judge handed the jury their instructions on how to reach a verdict. This was on April 29th. On April 30th, the jury was sequestered for roughly 11 hours before reaching a verdict. As can be expected, Rodney Alcala was found guilty on all charges. During the penalty phase, the state was seeking the death penalty for Rodney Alcala. My problem with that is pretty simple. If a state is not going to impose the death penalty, then they should not seek it for anyone, regardless of what the crime is. If you're not going to carry out a sentence, then imposing it upon someone is really a meaningless gesture designed simply to pat the back of the family and say, we did everything that we could. In my mind, it's no different from finding an individual who has been given life sentences or the death penalty for the crimes they have committed, as there is no way anyone is going to be able to collect on these fines. And I know they say, oh, it's a symbolic gesture. It's ridiculous to me. It's just grandstanding on the part of the state to do such a thing. Either impose and carry out the sentence, or impose a different sentence that you are going to carry out. During the penalty phase, the other inmate who had not testified informed the jury that Rodney Alcala had never made the statements that he was said to have made, stating that Robert Dove and Michael Herrera had made all of the things they told authorities Alcala had said up after reading newspaper reports and seeing media coverage of the alleged crimes in order to get a deal from the prosecution. Robert Dove ends up taking the stand and admits that he and Herrera had lied on the stand about the things that Alcala had said, stating that they had been trying to get a deal from the state and that this had led them to make false statements. And this is why prosecutors are very reluctant to put jailhouse informants on the stand because of just this type of testimony. And the fact that inmates will, in fact, turn around and lie on the stand if they believe they're going to get a reduced sentence or have charges dismissed. Despite these revelations, though, the jury does return a penalty of death for Rodney Alcala. On June 20th of 1980, Alcala is officially sentenced to death by the court, but this is not the end to Rodney Alcala's saga. In fact, it's going to go on for many, many years. Alcala ends up being transferred that evening to San Quentin's death row, where he was to await his execution in the state's gas chamber. However, Alcala had many, many appeals, and the first appeal that they go forward with concerns numerous points of contention. Prior to the trial starting and after jury selection, four of the jurors had been removed as they opposed the death penalty. The appeal also contended that the introduction of Alcala's past crimes had influenced the jury in their conviction of Alcala. The reason the judge had allowed introduction of Alcala's past crimes was because the state contended that they all contained similarities in age, photography, as well as Alcala using restraint to keep his victims captive in the car. However, the defense contended that no force of restraint had been used in the case of Monique weight, nor had any form of photography been used in the rape and attempted murder of Tally Shapiro. They also pointed to the fact that none of the three victims had been murdered, thereby eliminating the similarities in these cases. If you've listened to my coverage on the Atlanta child murders, we're currently covering Wayne Williams' trial. During Wayne's trial, the state was allowed to introduce 10 pattern cases that they said showed similarities in all of the murders and in the murders that Williams was actually on trial for, which were for two adult males. The only pattern that could be established during his trial was fiber evidence, and this in and of itself is not enough to establish a pattern in a court of law. To the point that the Georgia Supreme Court would later state, while Williams was indeed guilty of these crimes, that evidence should not have been allowed into court. And that is going to end up happening with Rodney Alcala. The California Supreme Court is going to look at this appeal and agree with the defense that the state had not, in fact, shown a pattern beyond a reasonable doubt to any of these crimes, and therefore, any reference to Alcala's prior convictions was not admissible as evidence. Further in the appeals, the testimony of both Robert Dove and Michael Herrera was brought up, stating that both men had lied under oath and that this lie had been confirmed during the penalty phase by Joseph Drake and Robert Dove himself. The last part of the appeal concerned the prosecution's statements that Robin Samose had been sexually assaulted during the course of her captivity, something the defense claimed emphatically no evidence existed to support. While all of this is going on, Alcala returns to court where he is found guilty in the Monique Hoyt case, convicted of rape and assault with the intent to inflict great bodily harm. Alcala receives a 9-year sentence. In August of 1984, based largely on the fact that the prior crimes had been admitted into evidence in court, Rodney Alcala's death sentence is vacated. This basically means that Alcala is going to get a new trial, and while the state of California does not release him from prison, he is officially off death row. In 1986, Rodney Alcala again goes on trial for the murder of Robin Samose. Dana Crapa refused to testify at this trial, claiming amnesia. During a pretrial hearing, Crapa takes the stand and states that she cannot remember anything involved with the discovery of Robin's body. Basically, as a psychiatrist testified, Dana was suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder, something that is known to cause impediments in memory retention. Because of this, the judge allows Dana's testimony to be read into the court record before the jury. The defense objects to this, stating, quote, "In only allowing the reading of the transcript without Dana Crapa being present, the court prevents the jury from evaluating her demeanor at the first trial. It is our strong opinion that she was nervous during her initial testimony, and her body language and other nonverbal clues suggested that she was not telling the truth at the time. In the denying the jury to now study that demeanor, the court renders the jury ill-equipped to make a decision on the honesty and credibility of the witness. In addition, this ruling will not allow me to cross-examine Dana Crapper about timelines and what she had seen on June 20th, 1979 that will result in the testimony becoming nothing but hearsay. When pressed as to what these nonverbal clues might be, the defense calls the judge from Alcala's first trial, Philip Schwab. Schwab informs the court that during her testimony, Dana had had substantial delays in between the questions being asked to her and her answers, with some of these delays lasting over a minute. The new judge ends up overruling this objection, and Dana Crapper's testimony is allowed to be read in open court. The second trial of Rodney Alcala began with little fanfare. While it was very similar to the original trial, there were a few differences. Firstly, Dana Crapper did not take the stand. Instead, her testimony was read into the record. No mention of the jailhouse informants nor of Alcala's previous convictions was allowed in to the court record, nor was defense witness Tim Fallon allowed to testify, as it was later found that he was unable to distinguish between Robin Simos and another 12-year-old girl whom he had been shown a picture of. As with his first trial, Alcala was found guilty and sentenced to death on August 20th, 1986. Alcala is returned to San Quentin to await his execution. Although he's not idle while he's sitting behind bars, he pens a book called You the Jury, in which he maintains his innocence and instead puts forth that a man by the name of Raul Vasquez was responsible for Robin's murder. According to this book, a Sierra Madre police officer had encountered Raul on the night of June 22nd, leaving the crime scene near mile marker 11. When questioned why he was there, Vasquez is reported to have stated he had been urinating in the woods while waiting for his girlfriend to come pick him up. Refusing to answer more questions, Vasquez was then frisked by the officer and a large wrench was found in his back pocket. According to this officer, Vasquez's demeanor was shaky and nervous. Obviously, many believe that this is simply Rodney Alcala's attempt at passing the buck towards another man who had been convicted of murder. Alcala was also continuing to work on his appeals, as California gives death row inmates almost an inexhaustible amount of appeals. One part of his appeal does need to be looked at, and that is the fact that Bridget Wilvert had apparently been hypnotized during her police interview on June 22nd, 1979, in the presence of both Marilyn Droz and Ron Jenkins. Why is this a problem? Hypnotism is seen as a pseudoscience in the eyes of the law, and therefore an individual who has undergone hypnosis is generally seen by both the prosecution and the defense as an unreliable witness, although prosecutions will oftentimes try and get a witness who was hypnotized admitted as a witness in a criminal case. More often than not, however, these individuals are barred from giving testimony, as it's thought that their testimony may be flawed and corrupted by the hypnosis process, wherein leading questions are asked of the witness, which will lead them to possibly concoct a false memory of what they saw and what occurred. Akala, however, remains behind bars, with appeal after appeal being rejected. The state of California continues to look into him as possibly being involved in more crimes. The FBI, as well as numerous other states, also get involved in this, looking at Rodney Alcala, who refuses to admit any form of guilt to any of the murders which he is suspected of being involved with, or which he has been convicted of. On March 30th, 2001, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturns Rodney Alcala's conviction because the jury had not been informed that Bridget Wilvert had been hypnotized. Now, while Alcala is sitting in the Orange County Jail, the state of California passes a law that allows the state to collect DNA from violent felons, that is, individuals who have been convicted of violent crimes. This leads to Rodney Alcala being connected to the 1978 murder of Charlotte Latham. DNA was found on a pair of earrings inside of Alcala's jewelry pouch, which matched the DNA of Lamb. Because of DNA, Alcala is going to be connected to Jill Barcomb from semen found on her genital region. He's linked to Georgia Wixt through that partial palm print found on the bed railing in her bedroom, along with DNA evidence from her vaginal region. The blood found in Jill Parentu's apartment matched that of Alcala, as well as bite marks that were linked back to Alcala. We've discussed this in a past, how bite mark identification has been proven to be a pseudoscience, in that human skin is not a solid object and moves, and is therefore able to mutate the bite mark of an individual. That's why many states no longer allowed into evidence. During this point in time, however, California still allows bite mark evidence. There is also the myth that DNA evidence is 100% irrefutable. It's been shown time and again how this is in fact not the case, even with all of the new breakthroughs that come in DNA gathering, collection, and identification. Many individuals are still wrongfully convicted using DNA evidence. That's not to say I don't believe that Alcala was responsible for these crimes, only that, you know, when we're looking at all of his cases, we have to remember this stuff, and we can't get lost inside of this myth that has been created that once they have DNA evidence, a person is 100% guilty of a crime, as it's not the case. No matter how hard the media, various law enforcement agencies, or the government tries to push it as such, it is still possible to get false identification through DNA. And I personally believe that we're going to see a lot more of this in the coming decades, of people being exonerated after it is found that DNA was incorrectly linked to them. In any event, with this information, the state of California begins to put a case together against Rodney Alcala, with all of his California crimes lumped together as one. Obviously, Alcala is going to fight this, stating, quote, my due process rights cannot be negatively modified simply because I haven't been brought to trial in a quarter of a century. Basically, what Alcala is saying is that he cannot be tried for all of these crimes together. They cannot link Robin's murder in with the others, as a court in 1979 would have disallowed the joining of these cases and would instead have insisted upon severance of the cases into individual trials. In November of 2005, Alcala is officially charged and pleads not guilty to raping and murdering Jill Barcombe, Georgia Wixt, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parentu. The following year, California's Supreme Court rules against Alcala, stating that these cases can all be joined together. Alcala appeals this again, further delaying any chance for a trial to take place. Jury selection for Rodney Alcala's new trial starts in December of 2009, with the trial set to start in January of the following year. The trial starts on January 11th of 2010. Alcala decides to defend himself this go-round. It's my speculation that Alcala more likely than not knew that he was going to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in these crimes, and that firing his attorneys and representing himself served two purposes. One, it all helped to bolster his ego, as he now would be solely responsible for his fate, but it also allowed him to inflict further harm on the families of his murder victims, kind of like a last fuck you to them, which is exactly what ends up happening, as Alcala is going to be able to cross-examine the state's witnesses and to drag things out of them that traumatize them. Alcala ends up taking the stand in his own defense, going back and forth between questioning himself and answering the questions. It was an extremely bizarre spectacle. The DA on cross-examination pretty much tears Alcala to pieces. Closing arguments end up being given in February 2010. The jury ends up deliberating for almost 2 days before coming back with guilty verdicts on all counts, and Alcala ends up being sentenced to death again. After this, numerous headlines start popping up all across the world saying that Alcala is the most prolific serial killer in history, with murders suspected being in the hundreds. I do want to point out that that is a misleading statement, as there are individuals, particularly in South America, who have been convicted for hundreds of brutal murders, one of whom I am considering covering on this show in the coming months. In all reality, it is very difficult to guesstimate how many murders Rodney Alcala actually committed, as outside of photographs, we simply don't have enough evidence to link him to any of these missing persons cases across the United States, and his whereabouts, for the most part, are fairly well known for any period of time. You couple that with the fact that nobody has come forward stating that, you know, the person in this photograph was my sister, or that they were my mother, etc., etc. It's highly dubious, in my opinion, that Rodney Alcala killed hundreds of women, or as some reports state, thousands. I think it more likely than not that Alcala possibly killed upwards of 30 young girls and women. However, given the information that we have currently available to us, that number in and of itself may be too high. With all of that being said, however, Alcala's days in court were not done at this point. Basically, what happened was the Huntington Beach Police Department began releasing digitalized copies of the various photographs that Rodney Alcala had taken during the period of time during the 1970s that he was free. And while many of these pictures could not be released as they were extremely sexually explicit, and there was no way for authorities to show the women's faces without showing other things that they did not want to release to the public, others were not. Two of these pictures happened to be of Cornelia Criley and Ellen Hoover. When these pictures were released, relatives and friends of the women in the New York, New Jersey area saw their faces and independently began contacting authorities in New York State. With DNA evidence, Rodney Alcala ends up being indicted for the two murders in 2011. After being extradited to New York, Rodney Alcala initially enters a not guilty plea for both murders before changing course and asking the court for permission to change his plea to that of guilty, stating that he wished to return to California in order to appeal his death sentences. The court accepts this, and Rodney Alcala ends up being sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, at which time he is extradited back to the state of California. In 2016, a woman by the name of Kathy Thornton was living in San Antonio when she came across the collection of photographs that had been released by the Huntington Beach Police Department, and in them she saw a picture of her sister, 28-year-old Christine Thornton. While Alcala admitted to having taken the photograph, he denied having murdered the pregnant woman. Alcala is linked to her murder and is formally charged in September of 2006. Alcala ends up spending the remainder of his life behind bars, this time at Cochran State Penitentiary. It has been stated that by the time the 2020s come around, Rodney Alcala is in increasingly failing health and is suffering from dementia, although I have not been able to find any independent information to back that last claim up. What we do know is that on July 24th, 2021, Rodney Alcala suffers a heart attack while he is in custody. He is taken to a Kings County hospital where he is pronounced dead at the age of 77. To this day, authorities continue to look for tips and information that might lead them to more murders committed by Rodney Alcala. You can still find the photographs that were released in the early 2000s online if you believe you might know someone who has been missing that could possibly have been a victim of Rodney Alcala. If you'll recall, his years active were the early 1970s up until 1978. If you do believe you may have known someone who might have been a victim of him, I strongly urge you to look at these photographs and then reach out to the appropriate law enforcement authorities. I hope that you guys have enjoyed my coverage of the life and crimes of Rodney Alcala. And until next time, stay morbid, and remember, leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and consider becoming a Patreon at tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. For as little as $1.99 a month, you get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content such as my look at the Columbine Massacre, as well as Vince McMahon and the Atlanta child murders. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid.